So last week we began with a simple assertion that God's intent is for us to live in freedom. Now maybe it doesn't feel like that on a day-to-day basis, but that is God's intent for us to live in freedom. And what is the purpose of that freedom? Okay, I don't expect, if you weren't here last week, you have an excuse. If you were here last week, then you're forgetful. All right. The purpose of that freedom is so that we are free to serve one another in the broadest of senses. So this is the first big idea. Remember, we're here because in one way or another, we're looking for ways to make good choices, and I think, and we'll address this a little bit more later, but the reality is that sometimes we don't know what to do, but just as probable, we want to be comfortable with what we've already chosen. Remember what we said last week, that a lot of times a person feels trapped by past decisions, and so they become paralyzed. They don't tend to choose well in the future. They try to put off choices. Try to avoid choices. So we are called to live in freedom. We're given the tools necessary to be able to live in freedom. But the purpose to that freedom is to serve. Now, we also said last week that God's intent is for us to enjoy this freedom. That has to mean that service is actually a form of enjoyment if we understand it well. That when I squander my freedom by living for myself, in the end, I become less satisfied. So think about a time in your own life, or maybe you want to look at somebody else's life if it's easier, and think about a person who is always chasing the next thing in life. The next experience, the next toy, the next... And we've all done this. So this is not a statement of judgment. This is just an evaluative tool. Have you ever chased the next thing, whatever the next thing is? And it's all about you. What happens when you get in chase mode? Describe that. What does it feel like? Okay, so you start to lose sight of the... Actually, of almost anyone and anything except for the next pursuit. What does that look like in your life?
Well, I was just listening to something about this, and the guy explained that the real issue becomes awareness. When your desire becomes to chase after this or to chase after that, what's really happened is you're suddenly aware of what you don't have. Like somehow the world's telling you that you need this, because when you didn't have it, you didn't care, right? You don't miss what you never had, and you never had it. But boy, man, I saw that car, I had to have it, and then my neighbor got it.
Okay, so we live in a state of perpetual discontent like that, but here's the other thing that I think is true for us. Life looks like that. A series of highs and lows, of peaks and valleys. What's here? I just got the new experience. What's here?
I didn't know where it's at.
I need another one. Oh my word, somebody just told me about this and I don't have it. And so you start to live like this. All right, so that makes a nice illustration on a board, but what happens when your life is like that and you're caught like that?
Your life works like that, you're caught like that. Never satisfied, always opposite, always never on a level. What the one thing we just did, the lesson is about stability.
Right?
There's never any stability because you're always chasing something. You're always up or down. Oh man, this sucks. You know, I really need this. Oh man, look at that. Oh, awesome.
Okay.
And there's never really, oftentimes people don't know how to take it either because you might be in a high or you might be in a low.
Okay, now let's just be very candid here. Service does not seem like the pathway to joy. Considering the needs of others does not seem like the pathway to happiness. At least initially, making me happy seems like the most logical way to my happiness, does it not? So this is a learned condition. All right, so that we said that the next thing that we're going to that we need to concern ourselves with is that there are two sorts of decisions that we have to make in general. There are just big general decisions. And then there are more specific decisions. So within the most general decisions of life, Jim is usually good for an example about this. It usually has something to do with the neighbor three doors down and how he didn't go kick the neighbor's door in. So we're not going to revisit any of them, but in the Okay. So Jim is living inside this inner boundary, which is God's moral guidelines. It's what we called last week God's law of love. The principles for living that He gives to us because He cares about us. Now, we have a choice every day. Do we stray outside that or do we stay within this? So in the broadest of senses, I can first filter my decision through these two things. Is it going to continue to help me to live in freedom? Is there going to be some sense in which it brings about the possibility for me to serve? Now, it doesn't mean that that choice, when you sit down to a great meal, you're not serving anyone in that moment. Here's the question. Does it impinge upon the future likelihood that you can serve? Does this decision limit my potential to serve in the future? So let's say that the next new high that you're chasing after is a new car. All right, but you don't really have the finances for the new car, and it's a pretty expensive car, and so we'll say that you go into some significant debt to get the new car, which means a heavy monthly payment. Does that enhance your freedom or limit it? Does it enhance then your capability and the potential that you have, the raw potential for future service, or does it restrict that? Okay, so then there is a simple guideline in broad senses and in very specific senses. Is this decision going to open up fields of opportunity for me to serve and therefore live in freedom, or is it going to restrict that? Then does it fit within God's moral law of love? It becomes the next filter. And then we said that when it comes to specific decisions, there's two additional things that we need to consider. Anybody remember them? It's the same illustration as last week, so I'm hoping that this jogs a little bit. So Jim is pulling out his notes. There was no illustration last week on the notes.
Well, you said the labor, so I have to look at my notes.
Okay. It looks like you need glasses, too. Or longer arms. There he goes. The glasses are on. There's the Santa we all know and love. All right, so two additional things. What's my purpose? What are the skills, the gifts, the talents that I possess? And so we said last week, the overlap area is my sweet spot in which I can be confident that my decisions are reasonable and sound. So it has to pass the first two tests, has to get inside God's moral law, then does it fit my purpose, and is it within my skill set? So one of the reasons we're actually doing this, I'll tell just in the most brief and non-specific of ways, one of the reasons we're doing this series is because I've had this struggle recently with whether I'm going to continue on doing what I'm doing. I mean, i.e. even things like on Saturday morning. Is this where I belong? And so I was going through a battle with this, and I thought, well, I know what my purpose is, and I truly, without sounding like this is phony or hype, I understand what my purpose is, and one of the things that my purpose is to be about is to help men to do exactly what we're doing here and to be able to live in freedom. All right, and I also know what my skill set is. Now, you think about this. What is your purpose? That might fit within my purpose, but it wouldn't fit within my skill set, and therefore I would not be serving in my sweet spot.
However, both of those things can change.
Somewhat. Do you have a specific example?
Well, I mean, you can be living what you believe is your call to, your purpose, and suddenly you feel called to this. Are you? Can you? What's your skill set? Well, what if I improve my skill set? Maybe I'll feel like I'm called to this. Well, because I just learned how to play guitar. And now I think I should be on the worship team.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think that...
Yeah, I think use the way you just used it in that illustration, that's true. If my skill sets change, then it's possible that even within a consistency of purpose...
That it's related to purpose.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. All right, now, can you see that? And we'll just erase these quickly. When these two circles are essentially overlapping, there's an incredible amount of area there. Right? It's not just, have you ever asked the question, what's God's will for my life? And you thought it had to be something very specific. But in fact, what we're looking at is that in most cases, there is an incredible amount of space where my purpose and my skill sets can be applied to almost anything within this broad area. Far different from, I need to find the best job, the ideal mate, the unique car for me, whatever it is. We're going to later on look at this, but actually, you know what? No, I'm going to take you to it right now. Backside of your first page, the very bottom, there's a thing called apprentices and journeymen. So apprentices are those who are new to something. An apprentice is a person who lacks both. Am I missing something? All right. Apprentice. Extreme. Jim, you don't have anything either. You should have spoken up. I'm sorry. Well, next week you're going to need to look at it so that you... So the apprentice, and this is a term that we don't use a lot unless you're Donald Trump and you have a reality TV show, but apart from that, an apprentice is someone who lacks significant and important knowledge, but they also lack experience. So what is the purpose of an apprenticeship? To gain both of them, right? To gain knowledge and to gain practical experience. Because one without the other is not helpful. To have raw knowledge but have no experience with how to use it still leaves me handicapped. We've all read a book about how to do something. Everybody's read a book about how to remodel their kitchen. Well, when you actually go about doing it, it feels a little different than it said so in the book. I read something recently, let me get the guy's name because it's one of these names that you really need to look at to pronounce. It is actually on the top of the last page, Atul Gawande. Anyway, the guy's got an amazing life story, I guess you'd say. He is a medical practitioner, he's an author, he's got 4 New York Times bestsellers under his belt, in addition to practicing medicine. In addition to that, he's a staff writer for the New Yorker, so the guy is really busy. One of the books that he's written is entitled The Checklist Manifesto, and in it he describes this particular situation. He says, up until about 50 years ago, in medical practice, knowledge was the problem. We simply didn't know enough to treat people well. He said today, more of the problem that most humans experience when they go in for any kind of medical treatment is not knowledge. It's not that the doctors don't know. It's that in the moment they don't execute the decisions in the order and with the faithfulness that they should. In other words, they actually know almost too much and can't manage everything they know in a timely manner. And so he said, and this was just his informal estimate, he believed that only approximately 40% of people who go in for any kind of significant medical treatment get the best possible practice for their situation. In other words, the wrong test is done, the test is misread, things aren't done in the correct order. In one way or another, the ideal and perfect system that we already understand is only executed faithfully 40% of the time. So,
what does our doctor say about that?
I don't know. I avoided eye contact the entire time.
That's what it's called in practice.
Yeah, we're still practicing. Yeah, no.
I think it's some people think when they go in there that this is a sound, this is firm, this is like law. Law is law, it's firm. This is what it says, this is what it means. Sometimes when they go in there, I'll give you a for instance. I had a root canal that went to in a hurry. And now I have half a root canal done. Because when she got in there, it changed. Things changed. She, whoa, we gotta stop, we gotta wait. You know, there's definitely something going on here. I need more information. We need to slow down. Thanks, Doc. Thanks for not just plow ahead and ruining, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of buzzwords that go around in medicine now. They all seem to be, have their origin in mathematics, metrics, best practices. And the longer I go, I realize that medicine isn't mathematics. And so everybody's in every situation is different. And you can have the same process in two different patients and have their expectations be totally different. I mean, and so, yeah, I have best practice. In the very simplest sense, the best practices of what preventive medicine should look like. In 2016, and you know what? Beginning of my career, we really got beat over the head because we weren't practicing. Well, after all these years, it really comes down to, really, at the end of the day, it's not many things. You know, some different things for men and women, different age groups they start, different age groups they stop. But at the end of the day, there aren't a whole lot of things. And I had this you know, wonderful, lovely Christian woman in my office who's 75 and says, I really don't want to do them. I'm trusting completely in the Lord. Well, you know, she falls out of the metric, you know. And quite honestly, now my computer tracks whether this lady gets a mammogram. At the end of the day, at the end of the year, I mean, that goes into the thing. If I don't have enough patients that in that 40 to 75 age group, that have had a mammogram, they potentially will take money away from me and my salary. So, medicine isn't mathematics, and there's often different ways to get to the same outcome too. So, I think I kind of know what he's saying. I'm just not saying that. I've been fortunate. I've practiced in what I would consider to be the civilized part of the United States here. Lots of medical schools, lots of, you know, it's a populated area. So there becomes a standard for the communities that is, I know, very different than, you know, some quarter of Arkansas. You
know? Yeah, the Panhandle of Texas. Here, Mike, put you on the plot of wood for a second while I sit you up.
The other thing I'd just like to say is that back to serving and the freedom of serving. I mean, I should have said it a few minutes ago. I've always kind of looked at serving as not an option in the Christian walk. Once you come to Christ, I mean, it says you've been saved through faith, not by your works, but then you can go on and serve the Lord for the works that He put before you. I kind of look at that as freedom because God says it's something that is part of the whole deal.
And yet that is still something that we...
And it's some place that everyone can serve.
Well, there's no question...
In that box.
Right, right. There's no question that that is the ideal, but does that mean that we actually believe that and do it?
Well, that's up to us to portray that.
I believe so.
Teach that and show that. And I think there's been, like anything, maybe a downfall at times. You know, the way we talk about Christ coming to this life, and that should be, because that's what Jesus, you know, but that needs to be for us. You know, this is what we're receiving, signing up for, and this is the privilege that we have, you know.
The challenge, too, is the freedom to serve. You know, and it's funny to have it like that.
And that's good.
It's the freedom to serve. You're not...
Because
God says, you know what, I would really love for you to give to this thing. You know what, this Easter thing, whatever the thing is, the local church, really like to give to this community project. I'd love for you to give this money, but Visa says no.
Right.
But MasterCard says no. But your mortgage company says no. Because you bought a house that you knew was too expensive. You got a car that you knew you shouldn't have. You bought a car that was way too expensive. And now you're a slave to the lender.
Right.
We put ourselves in slavery. That's what we do. And the world tells you to do it. The world says, oh, what do you mean you can't afford this? I'll sell you, I will give you that subprime.
Well, good. It's good you put it that way, because that is the equivalent. There's, bottom line, Satan doesn't want us to be free to serve.
He doesn't.
Right. Or to give, or to help. He wants you bound up, caught up in your bills, caught up in your money, caught
okay.
up in your job.
Okay.
And then you don't get that.
We get it. Yes. Okay, we're getting to there, okay? But we'll never get past review and on anything new if we don't soon. Okay, so we're all good so far. Then we said, I introduced this three-point system for making important choices. Anybody remember what it was? All right, the first... Oh, Paul's looking at the notes. Come on, Paul. Decide what you want. Go ahead, Paul.
Decide what you truly want, not wishy-washy. Decide what price you're willing to pay to achieve that objective. And decide in advance what things you will not do in pursuit of this objective.
That's good.
Okay, so remember last week we used the illustration of that bridge construction project in France? Right? 40 years, they're aware of the project that needs to be done. They want to find a solution, but for 40 years they agonize over how to meet all of the criteria. So remember what one of the criteria was, and we said it was one of the things that, putting it into that grid, it was one of the things, this is something we won't do. We won't build this thing that destroys the natural beauty of the area. So in other words, if we're going to build some sort of a structure, and that's why for a while they considered a tunnel, if we're going to build some sort of a structure, it has to be aesthetically pleasing, not just some ugly piece of concrete and steel. But one of the other things that they struggled with was, and this fits with the apprenticeship versus the journeyman, we're not sure if we know how to build this thing in a way that's going to solve all the engineering problems.
Tunnel from England to France, had to wait till technology to catch up. They didn't have anything to build that tunnel. That was, you know what I mean? They wanted it for a long time. They needed a very specific piece of equipment.
And so we said, and that's exactly in line with what this bridge idea is, we said that sometimes when you set a large enough goal, it forces you to develop new systems and practices in order to achieve the goal. Now, that means you can spend the rest of your life living safe and small and probably hit every marker that you set, achieve everything you set out for, and you will become nothing more than you already are in the process. One of God's objectives is to grow us up into greater levels of responsibility. That can happen if we set small, safe goals. Now, again, another one of these things that we struggle with. Is it possible to make a great choice, to make a choice that falls within all of this, puts me right there in the sweet spot? Is it possible to make a great choice and experience horrific consequences as the result of that? Of course it is. Because we don't understand the big picture. We don't understand. If we do something, it honors God. Does it honor God if it makes us struggle? Sometimes people think, well, this can't possibly be God's will. I must have made a bad choice. I must have chosen out here somewhere because I'm experiencing pain or suffering or difficulty. And nothing could be further from the truth. So if you look at your short-term results and say, I must have made a bad choice, you're going to live with frustration for most of your life.
First missionary to the Amazon lost their life. What if they say, you know what, we can't do this?
And so we said here, one of the reasons we said that we're fearful of making choices is that we're going to be trapped. Another one of the reasons is that we're going to have to live with regret. Now, do either of these feel like freedom? Does being trapped feel like freedom? Obviously not. It's the antithesis of it. Does living with a constant weight of regret feel like freedom?
What those choices?
They're
choices.
Well, they are choices, but if I think if I have an apprentice view of what it means to be a follower of Christ, and I believe that if I choose well, it's going to go well for me, then I'm going to be disappointed, and one of those two things must be wrong. Either my choice was wrong, and that's what most people think, or my expectation about what happens when I make a good choice is wrong.
That's always wrong.
Well, so that's what we're trying to realign people's understandings. A great choice doesn't inherently mean it will produce a great outcome, or at least not initially.
I find the opposite. You attack the world. The closer you walk with God. I see it.
And it's just flat out more difficult sometimes. Right? It will place more demands on me. If I live a life of more relative ease, there's fewer demands. There's sometimes less stress. As a matter of fact, we've all experienced this. You've decided to serve in some particular area, and then there's family demands that come up. Right? And then there's the discussions about, well, I'm doing this over here, but my family's expecting me to do this over here. And then there's the working out of all of that process. Maybe we haven't all experienced that. I don't know. I've certainly experienced that.
Well, I think, and so oftentimes, I mean, you're diagram there, well, but if you utilize that as a submersible, the deeper you go, the higher the pressure from the outside. The deeper you go, the more pressure there is. Anytime there's a slight chink, it seems to implode. You know, it crushes the vessel. And it's not dissimilar to what you have there. You know, as long as the pressure inside the vessel is equal to the pressure outside the vessel, you're okay. But let one of those things get a small hole in it. And now the outside pressure is too much. And that
well, that's the illustration that we used to diagram out character when we were going through that Every Father Needs to Know. When my internal fortitude is not as strong as the external, then I implode. But when there's stuff going on in me on the inside that is more powerful than the outside forces, then I explode. So it depends. Character, then, we said, is not what's actually inside me. Character is that firewall, or what you're calling that pressurized skin, that keeps inner and outer equal.
And is your skill set such that you can keep that where it needs to be? That it'll hold itself where it needs to be? Because sometimes that skill set that you're talking about...
All right, let's move on here. So we're going to start with begin week two. I don't know who makes these calculations, but we'll read this together. 70 decisions made each day, 25,500 then per year, and 1,788,500 in a lifetime. That seems like a lot.
Fatigue.
Oh, yeah.
And they say, you know what, I'm done making decisions. You choose.
Well,
they don't literally shut off.
We'll come back to that. You probably won't be here by that time, but we'll come back to that. So, what do you notice here? Based on what we've talked about, do you think that you make 70 unique, important decisions every day?
Depending on what you
say,
I said important.
Important. Okay.
What's that?
I'm not doing that today.
Okay. Paul said it's 69 or less today for him.
I'm not doing that today. Do I play golf this afternoon? You know, when do I mow the lawn? That may be it.
Okay.
I was on vacation. I made a decision. I'm eating all of that.
Okay, in fact, and here's what I'm going for, in fact, and this is consistent with what we've already said, most of us make very few important decisions in life. The majority of the decisions that we make are secondary decisions that either live in support of the primary decision or they work against it. So 30 years ago, John made a decision that he was going to live a long and healthy life. Last week, at the vacation buffet, John made multiple decisions that perhaps undermined that decision that he made years before to live a long and healthy life. So most of the time, it's not that we have that many big decisions. It's, are we going to honor the big decisions that we've made by making the small daily choices that support the big decision? So we've said it this way, right? It is my responsibility to manage well the choices that I've already made. But that means every day. So did you make a decision years ago to get married? Yes. You'll have to manage that decision even today. And don't pretend that you don't have options. You do. Even within the framework of decide what you won't do, i.e. decide you won't ever get a divorce, there are still plenty of options about the way you live out that marriage in the moment by moment of life that still keeps you safe in the sense that I won't get a divorce. Right? Plenty of daily choices that we have to make. So,
now you're talking about willingness.
Well, that's a choice.
That's most of it. What are you willing to do? You're talking about service. What are you willing to do?
Now remember, and this is why we introduced the apprentice versus the journeyman. The difference between experience and no experience. When I enter a marriage, I have very little knowledge and very little experience relative to marriage. I might have some theory. I might have taken some marriage counseling classes, might have read a good book on it. I know some other people who are married. So I have some body of knowledge, but I have no experience. In almost every area of life, the experiences we acquire teach us that life is not at all the way we theorized that it would be. So once I learn the way life really is, does that give me an excuse to opt out of the choices that I've made before? In other words, once I learn the way marriage really is, does that give me the choice or the ability to opt out of that?
Yes. Legally, yes.
Yes.
Get divorced. I can. I've done it twice. Legally, I can. Is it a good idea? No.
And that was before Christ.
It was. And I tell people, the only thing that's changed, because I met Paul right in the Narcotics Anonymous meeting.
See, now Paul's going to feel bad. Now he's going to think whether he should play golf or not. Now he's going to be agonizing all day. He won't even be able to enjoy his golf game.
No, because he knows enough to know that I do this. I'm on the board of it. I do stuff. You know, I feel like community. But oftentimes, you know, it can turn into that. You know, you're a slave to yourself. You're a slave to your own self, to your own greed, to your own thing. We put ourselves in a spot, and then we go, well, it's not my fault. I'll use myself as, well, it's not my fault, I'm an addict. That tired old law, once an addict, always an addict, is no longer tolerated. Says that in my literature. No longer tolerated. You know different. Everybody sitting in here knows differently now. You're free to serve. Service is required.
Okay. Right.
Just like Christ served the church, right?
All right. See you, Jim.
Yeah.
All right.
Sir!
Two more points before we get into Scripture. Jim may not get the last word, but he surely tries. Two more points. So here's the first one. When I set big goals, large goals, stretch goals for my life, and when I start to live into them, this is a region where God and I can have fellowship. So faith is not just this abstract trust in God. Faith is actually a trusting in God to partner with me and help me within whatever it is that I'm doing here. And if the goal is large enough, if the purpose for living is large enough, then it almost demands that God come into it. Now sometimes you hear people say about how small and unworthy and incapable they are. I don't believe, this is my assumption, I do not believe that it is God's objective to make us feel small and insignificant so that we become dependent on Him. I believe that large goals tend to make us feel small and perhaps inadequate, and we run to God for some additional help. But this is the whole idea of this relationship. I really believe this is part of the plan. That God invites us into things, if we're willing, that take us beyond our capability and invite us into partnership with Him. not to make us feel small, but because fellowship is found in doing big things together. So if you've been in a marriage for any length of time, you might find that the marriage gets stale when all you do is try to look into each other's eyes and be absorbed with each other, right? But if you look outside and you start to say, what are the things that we could do together, it brings some new life to the relationship. That's exactly the way fellowship with God is. What are the things that God and we, and God and I, God and you, can do together? Because that creates common bond. A relationship built only on just sitting around and looking into each other's eyes is not much of a relationship. So that's the first thing. Your big goals give you an opportunity to have deeper, richer fellowship with God. If you settle for small, you're probably going to settle for smaller relationship with God.
When you just describe that whole thing, it seems to me, though, you're trying to make it sound like this new endeavor that you have with God is almost kind of like a one-on-one buddy thing, whereas I'm thinking more in terms of every aspect of life is you are totally dependent upon God. In other words, He's here, you're the apprentice.
Right.
I think the word dependent needs to be set, because without Him, even the project isn't going to get it.
But I also want us to hear that you can live a small and safe life and never need God.
That's true.
Say it again.
You can live a small and safe life and never need God.
Small and safe.
Small and safe. You can live that life on a daily basis, but if you voluntarily put yourself out there, then it's more likely that you will experience your dependence on God. All right, the next thing, we talked last week about spiritual fitness. I think it's important that you know when it's time, when you're fit to choose. Now, the psychologists tell us that there are times when it is suboptimal to make a choice. If you're under a lot of stress, if you're living in fear, if you're exhausted, or whatever it is, that's probably not the best time to make a critical choice. So, all the other circumstances lined up, don't make the choice if you don't have to make the choice if you don't feel that you are at that moment fit to make the choice. So emotional highs, emotional lows are bad times to make a choice. Exhaustion, a bad time to make a choice. So don't make a critical choice when you're not in a spiritually fit condition. If you're trapped in a season of significant doubt, and sometimes we go through seasons of doubt. Some people don't. Some people say they skate through their whole life and they never have any big questions about God. I don't know. That's not been my experience. So, if you are in a season where you're really struggling with something, you might not be spiritually in the right condition or the right frame of mind to make a good choice. To say no to something permanently or to say yes to something permanently. Just keep that in the back of your mind. All right.
But they include significant unconfessed sin. You know what I mean? I mean, if you're struggling with something that is just, and you haven't gotten through that, or you've not confessed that, then that's, I think, a pause in the point as well.
The trap there, I think, is that if you're dealing with an unconfessed sin, you're probably in a spiritually unfit condition, which means you're probably not going to be sensitive to the fact that you probably shouldn't make that decision then. In other words, you're actually working against your own spiritual fitness, which blinds you to the fact that you're probably not fit to make the choice right then. That's the dilemma. He's 100% right. It's just that I don't think we'll be aware of it at that moment. Of course, we've all done that kind of thing. All right, so now turn over to Romans, please. We're going to start at the end of chapter 11. So Paul's just gotten done crafting a statement about the difference between Jews and Gentiles and the fact that it is actually resulted in benefit to the Gentiles in certain respects, that the Jewish people are now rejecting, many of the Jewish people are now rejecting Christ. So the thing that was to be the high point, the great experience, the promise of Abram fulfilled, this Messiah that would come, the very people to whom he was sent have had a cool and indifferent acceptance of him, if any acceptance. This is, well, as a matter of fact, what that's done is turned more of the people who are his ambassadors toward the Gentiles to reach out to them. And as they've discovered that that's possible and that God had an interest in the Gentiles all along, well, then they pursue that. And so at the end of that, almost as if he were going to close out this written work, we come to this at verse 33. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. We're just going to read this through and then we'll come back and unpack it a little bit. How unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who has been his counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay him? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen. All right, now this is an interesting hybrid. There are some pieces of this right here that are lifted directly from another passage of Scripture. So verse 34, for instance, comes directly from Isaiah 40. We're going to go to that in a minute. The following comes from Job. But yet there's this other stuff that's commingled in with it. Now here's the first big thing that I'd like you to remember. Your ability to be able to handle Scripture and merge ideas and draw out things from them is critical to your ability to make decisions. Remember what we said here. This is God's law of love. Your ability to be able to know and then process God's law of love comprehensively gives you the ability to make good decisions and be at peace with them. That's our goal. It's not just make a good choice. It's make a good choice and live with a sense of inner peace after I've made the choice, even when things are difficult for me. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. Now, that's an interesting statement. So here he's saying, God has an infinite supply of wisdom, and the wisdom is valuable. Do you know people have a lot of information, but not much of it is useful? Sports statistics? I don't know. The Jeopardy players, right? Jeopardy players must have a wealth of useless information. I don't know what you do with that in your day-to-day life. I just don't. But what Paul is saying is, God has great wisdom. It's valuable wisdom. If you want to live a life that matters, then God has got some things that can help you. How unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out. Now here's the next idea that he introduces. It's hard to figure life out. Have you ever wanted to have all the pieces of the decision result in place before you decided? Right, and this is going to take me to here, and that's going to take me to there, and 5 years out I'll be here, and 25 years out I'll be living in the little cottage by the beach, and there'll be this chair there. Right, we want to do that, right? Here's what he's saying. When you look at all the interconnectedness of everyone's decisions and everyone's relying on or not relying on God, when you look at the whole big thing, you probably can't figure it out. What's he basing this on? What he's saying essentially is, if I would have looked back on Jewish history, I would have never concluded that we were going to be here. I would have never thought that that guy was the Messiah. I would never have figured that it would play out like this. I certainly wouldn't think that I would have found myself doing what I'm doing, where I am. This is Paul talking right now today, if I would have planned my life out. Who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay him? Now we get into the next, what I think is very important part. For from him and through him and to him are all things. Okay, so three critical things. From him. That means God has given us the raw material from which all of our decisions, all of our options are possible. But not just from Him. So God is not just like Amazon that's a fulfillment center. God is actually the creator of what He fulfills. So God is both the manufacturer of the situations and the deliverer of the situations. Pretty important. But it's the last part that's the most important. And to Him are all things. Your freedom to choose is a gift given to you by God that allows you to worship Him through the way that you choose. So that's the next big thing. Are your decisions...
My translation has toward Him. For that third component there. From Him, through Him, and for Him.
Well, to Him or for Him, I would say they're not that dissimilar.
Do you think that means past, present, and future?
I would certainly say so. Can you see a way in which this decision that you're going to make is going to have the opportunity to bring some honor to God? Now, not out of a slavish sense of obedience, but simply because it would bring you delight. It would bring you delight in this relationship to bring some honor to God. So we've put three boundaries, right? This is all of the options available to you, good and bad. This is God's moral law, law of love. Inside of that is we're going to say, is this a decision that right now would bring honor to God? God has given you the ability to choose whatever you would like to choose. It is your call. And the amazing thing is God has given you all the resources needed to choose badly. But it is only if you have the resources to choose badly that your choices have any meaning if you choose well. I don't know if that made sense to you, but if you had no choice to do bad, then a good decision would be meaningless. And we move into chapter 12. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy... In other words, everything that He's afforded to you, everything that He's given to you that you didn't create on your own, that you should offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. All right, now, what do we say a person's spiritual life is? Say this again and again, so many times that surely somebody has to get this right. It's a hard issue. So let's start with what's the heart. Okay, so the heart is what we've said is the seat of my decision making and my reasoning. That's the heart. The scriptures does not use the word heart in a mushy Hallmark sense. It is literally the intellectual, rational seat of where I make all of my choices. That's why it's such a powerful statement. Okay, so our spiritual act of worship, the inner man's the ability to choose and act in certain ways, that's a spiritual act of worship. I am making an inner man choice to do this specific thing. Do not conform any longer to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. It gets right back to that mind thing. Now, here's the next thing. So we're going to stop right there. Don't look any further. Have you ever said, I wish I knew what God's will was for my life? Do not conform any longer to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what is God's will, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. When you really look at this, do you realize what it just said there? You get to put the stamp of approval and decide whether something is God's will or not. Your inner man decisions and the way that you have renewed your mind, prepared your mind, and equipped your mind essentially authorizes you to say, this is God's will. Now that does one of two things for you. That either makes you arrogant and dangerous, or it makes you humble and fills you with a sense of the need for dependence on God. You are going to be the final arbiter of whether something is God's will in your life. The proof of that is how many times have you gotten a yes or a no, this is God's will? How many times have you had that? I mean, I know there's stories in the scriptures about how God speaks one-on-one with people. How common are those stories? Why do you think they're in the scriptures to begin with?
God wanted them.
Okay. They're rare, they're unique, and they're special. And they point to specific times. It's not the common experience. We wouldn't say that people are crazy when we say, well, God told me to, right? When you hear somebody say, God told me, we wouldn't think that was crazy if God spoke audibly and convincingly to people every day. People struggle with sensing God's will. People struggle with this because we're looking for God to give us some sort of a specific answer. But instead, what it is we are to discern what God's will is, which already exists. Remember what Paul said? Is that past, present, or future? God's will is already established. Past, present, and future. It is up to you in the moment to discern the plan, the good plan that God has. And then remember what we've said, it's not enough to make a decision. I have to faithfully manage the choice that I've made.
It says here, then you will be able to test and prove. I mean, there's some real, it almost gives you the sense that there's going to be some trial and error and a back and forth process, you know, so you can really find out if that truly is God's will for you. I mean, it isn't going to just all of a sudden.
Can I read something?
Yep.
Study Bible. It puts to the test and finds the thing tested meets the specifications laid down. A lot of what you're saying, in fact, is what more or less means. Study Bible.
So, this grid actually allows you to start to do that. That's why we're using it. This grid starts to allow you to put your future decisions into some sort of a matrix and start to evaluate them. Right? Is it within God's law of love? Does it produce the ability to give God some sort of honor? Does it fit my purpose? Is it within my skill set? And we're going to look at one more thing yet. So at the end of this, and this is why he says this, but that you shouldn't think more highly of yourself than you ought to, because he's just said that you are going to be the arbiter that puts the stamp of approval on God's will. You are going to be the one here on earth who is going to make that choice. And we see that with the church, right? We see that with the church and man's influence on... Right? We get a bad reputation because the church has done a lot of bad things over the years, right? People within the church have done some crazy things over the years. We've done a lot of great stuff. Nobody remembers anything but the bad stuff that the church is responsible for, right? When you think Catholic Church, do you think anything good? Right? All you think about is all the stuff that's been in the newspapers or this or that or the other thing. When you think evangelical, what is the way that the word evangelical Christian is normally used in the press? Is it positive or is it negative? It's usually negative. Okay? God has put his whole reputation, and we've said this before, God has essentially placed his reputation in our hands. And it's up to us to decide how we're going to handle God's reputation. Is it going to bring him honor? For by the grace given to me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourselves more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourselves with sober judgment in accordance with the measure of faith that God has given you. In other words, just because you have the ability to put your stamp of approval on God's will, don't let that go to your head. Make sure that you keep a humble, a contrite, an open spirit about you. And then he goes into this illustration, which is extremely helpful here. Just as each of us has one body, but with many members, and these members do not all have the same function, so in Christ, we who are many form one body, and each member belongs to all of the others. We have different gifts according to the grace given to us. We'll stop right there. So here's the next thing. My circles are not the only ones within this boundary. So when I make decisions, I not only have to ask, is the decision right for me, fitting my purpose, but how does my decision affect, or how will my decision be affected by all the other individual people within the community of Christ, each with purpose and each with a set of skills. So is my decision going to take something from them and hog it? Is my decision going to impinge on their freedom and their opportunity to serve? So that's the final litmus test. How will my personal decision impact all the other people to the degree that I'm aware of it? And then he goes on to be to some specific cases of this. But the important part is the more general sense. These other things that become the unique spiritual gifts are simply examples of the bigger principle that we've already read. We have different gifts according to the grace given to us. If a man's gift is prophecy, let him use it in proportion to his faith. What does that mean? So what's the gift of prophecy? Generally speaking.
I recently heard a definition that it's to glorify God.
Okay. Basic mechanics, it is to be able to speak a word as if it is coming from God. You become the prophet of God, the representative of God. It doesn't necessarily mean it has something to do with what's going to occur in the future. It could be, I believe that God is saying this to us right now for this specific time. Notice how he says that we're supposed to prophesy if that's our gift? According to the measure of faith that we have. What does faith have to do with prophecy? And believe that it's coming from God. To believe what you're saying, he says, so make sure that you're confident. Now think about this. How much confidence do I have in God's ability to communicate with me if I'm going to say this is coming directly from God? It's a lot. He says, so in the measure, according to the amount of faith that you have, speak this word exactly that boldly. If you have only a little amount of faith, speak it with only a little boldness. But as your faith and your confidence in what you're saying grows, that you believe this is coming directly from God, then you can speak with a greater level of boldness. What's the next one? If it is serving, let him serve. Now that's easy, right? There's no mark. It doesn't seem as if serving requires some revelation from God. But how I serve might, where I serve might. Remember one of the things that we've already said, but we'll repeat it actually, it's somewhere in the notes there. Every yes that I say also is a no. Every choice that I make to do one thing means that I will not do 20 or 30 others. So my commitment to serve is as much a bold statement about what God is calling me to do and my stamp of approval on it as your prophesying is. Why? Because every act of service means a non-act of service somewhere else. I cannot do two things at the same time. I cannot be two places at the same time. Therefore, every yes actually is more about no's than it is about yeses. Incidentally, this is another helpful principle. You want to decide you want to make good decisions? Decide the things also that are distractions. If you understand your purpose, what are distractions to your purpose? You can eliminate a lot of decisions, a lot of the need to make choices, simply by saying, does this fit within my purpose? If it's a no, well then, that's a done deal. You don't need to worry about it. Right, so when John joked before about, does that mean I'm going to be on the worship team? Right? I already know. That doesn't fit within who I am. That's a no. I don't need to agonize over that. I won't lose any sleep, and I won't feel bad about saying no to that. If it is encouraging, let him encourage. Where would be the faith stretch in there? If it is encouraging, let him encourage. Well, that sounds really profound. Anybody? Why would he need to even say that? How is faith and encouragement related? Okay. Have you ever said to yourself, I should probably say something to somebody, but it probably wouldn't matter anyway. I should probably give them a good word or say something kind or compassionate or charitable to them. But it probably wouldn't make that much difference anyway. What happened there? You had no confidence in your ability to be the voice of God in that moment. You had no faith that what you were going to do really mattered, and therefore you didn't do it. the opportunity was lost. That means that your chance to have some influence in another one of these circles is now gone. Incidentally, in light of however many decisions we have to make in a lifetime, whatever that was, X number of million decisions, how many bad decisions do you make in the day to day? A word of encouragement, or I don't make the word of encouragement. A simple, small act of service, or I don't offer the act of service. Right? We're looking for the big things, and maybe that's not it at all. Maybe it's the small daily decisions. And look at what that statement says. Right? It is all of those small daily decisions that actually make up your life. It is the 70 decisions every day that actually make your life. So it's what you do in the moment that counts more than the big, oh God, show me your will. Let's get back to this. If it is contributing to the needs of others, let him give generously. Where's the faith in that? What's your temptation when God calls you to give boldly and big? I can't afford to do that. What's going to happen? What about my other needs? Will I be taken care of? If it is leadership, let him govern diligently. Faith component there? Can God really give me the wisdom to lead well? Can I be a bold leader? Or should I be a safe leader? Am I going to just do what people have done for generations before because that looks like leadership? Or am I actually going to leave an imprint on my generation by the things that I do? They may be controversial, they may be difficult, they may stir up people to be upset against me, right? If I don't have faith that God is working through me, if I really don't believe that God is working through me, then as soon as I meet opposition, what am I likely to do? Why not? Because if it's only me doing this, then my opinion's no better than Dave's or Paul's or Ron's. I mean, it just doesn't matter. But if God has actually called me to this position of leadership, then my influence and my position actually does matter. But how do I affirm that on a day-to-day basis? It comes back up to the top of the page. Well, the top of my page. It might not be the top of your page. It's the renewing your mind thing. If I am not every day reaffirming, okay, this is my call, this is my purpose, this is where God has placed me, and I've made this choice, here's another one of these boundaries that we need to insert. We've talked about it, but I should really just put it here. We're going to put it outside. So there's a lot of boundaries here. So this is anything that I could do. This is God's law of love. This is this next boundary that we're going to talk about. If I have chosen something, I have now become responsible for it. There is no option. So if I have chosen to have children, I don't need to ask about whether it's within my gifting and my skill set to manage children, right? I've made that choice, and I am therefore responsible for that choice. So it really doesn't matter any longer. I better get good at it. I better learn how to do it because I have made that commitment, and it is, we'll say, an irrevocable commitment, or it should be an irrevocable commitment. So I don't need to agonize over it anymore. It's a done deal.
Doesn't it all come down to faith, though, at a certain point? Like, if you don't have the faith to follow through on all these things, that's where it crumbles.
It's true. Always take faith.
If you don't have the faith that God has put you into a position or told you to be a leader, then no, it's all troubles.
It does. And therefore, one small seed of doubt can make a huge difference in how effectively you live this out. A little bit of doubt makes you a timid person. Timid people don't do anything well. Timid people are fearful. Well, what happens when you're feeling bold? The phrase that we use, the being in the flow of things, right? What is that? Where does that come from? It's being confident and secure so that you can make a sound decision. When you're a parent, you've got teenagers, and this is such a, again, a low-hanging fruit example. I realize this. When you are confident of what you are speaking about, you can resist the challenge of the, we'll say, rebellious teenager. When you're not confident, what do? A lot of times you back down. You give them more latitude than maybe they should have.
It's amazing how much that little mustard seed of doubt can be so much bigger than that little mustard seed of faith. I don't know how to explain that, but it's huge.
I don't think you need to explain it because it's the common human condition. For the most part, it is the common human condition. That's why the perpetual renewing of the mind is essential, because every day, well, a little bit of exhaustion. Have you ever been tired? Then when you're tired, you start to second-guess decisions. You don't feel like you have the energy to follow through on the decisions that you've made. There's so many things that affect this. So, yeah, your faith, that small bit of faith, is so fragile. It needs to be cultivated and cared for every day. All right, let me see if I have left anything out or if we're going to be done here soon. Ah, here's a good one. Let us go over to the second page. Can read this together. It's right underneath the, it's about a third of the way down the page, right underneath the underline text. To live with fear is to be human. Now that's an uncomfortable, disconcerting thing. To live with fear is to be human. To live under fear is to make it your Lord and you its subject. Who is your Lord? And so at the moment when you cave into fear, what have you made fear? Your Lord. And at that moment, God is no longer your God. Fear becomes your God because it becomes the thing that you obey. Have you ever obeyed fear? I mean, I know it doesn't. That's not the way we would word it. We don't obey fear or disobey fear. But in fact, yeah, we do.
We let fear overtake us.
And then this line from Andy Stanley, uncertainty is certain. To have it control and manipulate you is optional. All right, let me see if there is one other thing or two that I'd like to cover here. You don't all have to be quiet. Somebody could have something to say right now. That would be thoroughly okay. Yeah, let's do this. It's good you were all here from the beginning to see all that mess on the board, because if somebody would have walked in at the end and tried to make heads or tails out of all that mess on the board.
You need an extra sketch. To shake it.
All right, so here we're going to just have this simple illustration. It's on your sheet, but who or what is the center of the control of this situation? No, the diagram isn't there. I mean the word, no. So are things out here controlling your life? Or are you the primary influencer of your life? Now, this is really important for this reason. When you are convinced that circumstances outside of you and outside of your control are the primary dominator and governor of your life, then what can you do about it? Well, very little. If things out here control your life, let's call it fate. If fate has the control of your life, if it is the government, if it is the town, if it is the company that you work for, if all of these other things control your life, then how much influence do you actually have in your life? There's nothing left for you to influence. However, if you believe that God has granted you influence and authority within your sphere, that puts the control closer to over here and not as far over here. And every day you and I have to make a choice. Do we live with authority, under authority? Remember the Roman centurion that Jesus praised? Why did he praise him? He hadn't understood authority. He said, I am a man who is under authority, but I am also a man who has authority. He understood the relationship. So where does our authority come from? It comes from God. So to the degree that I have faith to believe that I am actually a man who is under authority, I have authority. And to the degree that I have authority, I have influence and control over my sphere of life. If I am not a man under authority, then where does my authority come from? Only from me. Right? We know we don't have control over life. Right? You go out here and within a half an hour, that'll be put to the test. If you think you are in control of life, within a half an hour, life will prove you wrong. But if you are a man who is under authority, we come back to this thing here that we said, for from Him, God, and through Him, God, and to Him, God, are all things. And God has granted a slice of that authority to you. You only receive it by your faith and trust in Him. This determines where that center of influence is. So put it to the test. In the last week, did you at one time or another believe that you had no control over a situation? That you were completely powerless? That the real control lived out here somewhere? And at that moment, what you said was that this thing was bigger than the God who has granted you authority. It doesn't take but 5 minutes to forget all that. It doesn't take but 5 minutes for that entire amount of faith, that little mustard seed of faith, to crumble, and then you're back there to living like this again. The cure for that? Again, the renewing of your mind. Like if you've got it, literally, if you have to make some sketches or some illustrations, I love doing illustrations. I think kind of visually, so I do these kind of really bad illustrations. Even though I think this way, I clearly have not practiced it. No, the upside down triangle. Haven't you ever seen one of those slider things where for volume or whatever, and you... Right, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? What rock do you live under? Come on.
What was that? What the triangle thing is?
It's the thing that would move. Yeah. But it slides. This thing would be like if you had a volume.
When you go to the doctor and you see that, when you stand on their scale, and you have they move that triangle back and forth. That's what that is.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah, but when you're on a scale, going to the right is not there.
You know what? We're just going to erase this.
They never use the digital scale. They have that.
I understand your artwork.
Thank you. All right, I think we're going to wrap it up right there. Anybody else have any... There's not enough time to get into anything else important, so if anybody has any final points, if not...
Go ahead.
I was just
going to
say what you're saying in some sort of way, doing much is given, much is required. Kind of poor.
Well, that's true, and I think the thing that I was going to dovetail on that is that... As you were just going, you know, briefly through that little list of spiritual gifts there, you know, the gift of encouragement, you know, the gift of prophecy, but then, you know, the gifts of leadership, I think there's a definite linear relationship with spiritual fitness
for those things. And of course, that comes into the whole ascertainment of what our spiritual gifts are, which I think is still part of your process here where, as we introduce people to the church, you know, to find out what your gifts are. And you know, what's interesting about that is, I mean, some of the places where I serve, you know, things that require the least amount of, you know, the years I've walked with the Lord or experience or biblical truths that somehow made their way up here can still be some of the most gratifying. And when, you know, like a few years ago, when Ryan sent out an email, says, I need readers, Kathy and I were kind of looking for something, you know, that we can do together, you know, and said, well, let's do that and everything like that. Now, let's face it, I mean, I don't need to do anything special when I show up to be a greeter at the 11 o'clock service.
You don't study a lot.
So I don't have to prepare anything. You know, I don't need to, like, that's a whole different situation. When my wife and I are up front on the prayer team and somebody who's coming forward, I have, like, no clue what their issues are. And, you know, it's kind of like the emergency room of prayer. But I have to tell you that, you know, the first time we did the greeter thing, it's like, we walked out of here, you know, with a spring in our step and a smile on our face and said, you know, this was just oh, you know, this is a fun ministry, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's the point of that is there's a place for everybody to serve in the body of Christ.
Amen. That's good.
Okay. Let's pray. And